are in Perek Yud Chet, chapter 18, and actually I think we can wrap the chapter today. We'll see whether that actually works out, but it's a pretty fast-moving Perek. It really does move along, so I think that we have a chance of it. Remember, chapter 17 was all Micha and Levi. Levi showing up, saying, yeah, I'm a little bit out of luck, looking for a place where I can make my way. And he says, well, look, isn't that wonderful? I have this statue here, and it would be great. I'd be so happy if we could come to terms. And so he goes to work for Micha. I want to note a couple of things. First of all, Rob, welcome back to being with us. And your family should have nechama, and we did learn in memory of your father last week, and this week the learning is dedicated, first of all, in general, Michael and Ruthie Mammon have dedicated the year's learning, and then for this session we also associate it with the following donations from our day of giving in July, from Alan Fink, from David Freilich, and from Sheldon Diesenhaus. So thank you very much. So we found out about Micha and the Levi, and then we started the chapter with the tribe of Dan, and we spent a lot of time figuring out what exactly it is that Dan is doing here in this chapter. Clearly, they're not happy with their portion in the southwest of Israel, whether it's because the portion isn't big enough, whether it's because they're having difficulty conquering it, or some combination thereof. And they decide to conquer land way up north at the top of the Yarden. We saw a debate as to whether the land is west of the Jordan or east of the Jordan. Is it even in Israel at all? Is it part of their portion that they were supposed to get? Is it not? All of these things were discussed last week. But now, the tribe of Dan, having shown up at the house, having questioned the Levi about what he's doing there, are ready to go to this land that they are investigating. The land which was called, in the book of Yehoshua, Leshem, and here it is called Laish. So, if you take a look at chapter 18, sentence 7, I'd like us to just read through a few psukim, And I think we'll see something interesting going on here. So we're going to read through Sukkim Zayin to Yud, sentences 7 to 10. Vayelochu chameshes ha'anashim. These five men who are this reconnaissance group, they went, vayavohu Laisha, and they came to Laish. Vayir'u es ha'am asher bekirba yosheves lavetach, and they see that the people who are living in Laish are living securely. Right? Lavetach. Betach, you may recall from Sefer Bereishis, is a term that's used to describe the people of Shechem before Shimon and Levi show up, and then there is no more, you know, Shechem. But but Betach is to be secure. Hashem promises that one day we will live Betach. We will live securely on our land. Well, these folks are living securely and safely. Kimishpat Tzidonim, just like the people of Tzidon, Shoket Uvoteach, quiet, secure. Ve'ein Machalim Davar Ba'aretz, Yoresh Etzer. Those words are really, really hard to translate. I'm going to come back to those words. I just want to complete the sentence. Urechokim Hema Mi Tzidonim, they're far from the Tzidonim. Ve'davarein Lahemim Adam, they don't deal with anybody. They're good, they're happy, they're just hanging out in their land, being secure, until the steamroller is going to come through. So, there are a few things we need to understand in this pasuk, just basic. First of all, I mentioned that this place is called Laish here, but back in Yehoshua, where it mentioned Dan conquering it, it was called Leshem. So, I brought you a Rashi on your sheet who tries to explain the discrepancy. He says, "Ubesefer Yoshua koreishma Leshem." In Yoshua, we call it Leshem. Al shem shematzu sham even etova, because they found a gem there, sheshma Leshem, which is called a Leshem. Vehi haisa lachoshen l'shevet Dan. And in fact, it's on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol for the tribe of Dan. So in other words, Leshem is a stone that is found in this area. It happens to be a Dan stone, so it makes sense that Dan would be the identified with this location. And so that's how it gets the name Leshem. Shmo Kasuv HaLeshem, his name, the name of Dan, is written with the Leshem. V'yadushev emes hinachal asam, and that told them they belong there. What Rashi is doing fundamentally, really it's a Medrash I think that he's quoting, but what Rashi is doing here is he's taking the view that Dan really belonged in this place. That Leshem was actually their portion. They weren't just taking some random place where the people living are vulnerable, but rather this was really supposed to be theirs. It wasn't inappropriate. And as we've noted, that's not everybody's view, but he's saying it fits. Look at it. It's called Leshem. Leshem is the stone of Dan. It all adds up. That's number one. But then you get that turn of phrase in the middle of the sentence. Ein machlim davar ba'aretz yoresh etzer. Anybody here working from an English translation? Okay, Chuck, which translation do you have?
It's Arya's translation, which I think is JPS.
Right, so it's JPS 85 by default. Okay, so what does that one say?
I'm just trying to quote it. It says, tranquil, unsuspecting people with no one in the land to molest them and with no hereditary.
Okay. Ein machlim davar, they take as no one around to molest them. Machlim, they're taken as being some form of harassment. And there's no one to harass them in the land. And they also don't have hereditary rule. Why would that fit here at all? Who cares if they have hereditary rule? Why is that relevant? We didn't have hereditary rule. How'd that work out? I'm sorry, what, Howie?
They are not tied to the land.
Why is that sure that they're not tied to the land?
Because no one has specific property.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's okay if somebody else takes it from them, because they don't really have they're just passerby.
But just because you don't have a hereditary ruler?
What does it mean, hereditary rule?
It means that the when we have a king, the king passes it to his son.
Mm. Oh, that's what it means. Okay, I thought it meant to the land, like they don't have a land registry.
Right. No, it means there's no, the king does not pass it to his kids.
I see, okay. Mm.
I don't know how you get another king. I don't know whether this means it's a free-for-all when the king dies, or there's a parliamentary election. Like, it doesn't say what happens. What happens if you have an election and then the previous king says no, I'm still king? Like what exactly is your process here if it's not hereditary rule? So this is difficult. This is difficult to understand. What else do we see here as a possible explanation? Who else has translations? I see what Chuck wrote, but holding off on that.
Sonsino.
Yeah. What does Sonsino do?
Sonsino says that there was none in the land possessing authority that might put them to shame in anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a note talking about how it's unclear.
Yeah, it is very unclear. There's no one to put them to shame. That's Machlim. And what do they do with Yoresh Etzer?
Yoresh Etzer, the Barba Arts Yoresh Etzer, none in the land possessing authority. But like I said, the note says that its meaning is uncertain. The literal translation seems to be one who inherits power of restraint and may signify heir to the throne. And then they discuss Rashi.
Okay. Like the idea mentioned. Anybody have a translation that does anything different here?
Yes. I have a Mamlez translation.
Uh huh.
And it is, there was none that disgraced anything. Nor was there any that inherited power.
Okay, so they've got the inheriting power on Yoresh Etzer. None that disgraced anything is very interesting. It's a little bit towards Rashi, although not so much. So this is a really hard set of comments. Yeah, Dan, what do you have?
I don't have a translation, but an idea.
Yeah.
what if it meant there is no nachalat, there is no obligation to return the land at Yovel?
But how would
One who conquers it has it forever.
I mean, they're not Jewish. They can do whatever they want, you know, there. But how would that fit with the words in Yoresh Etzer? So this whole thing is very difficult to understand. Let me add a complication. If you go back and look at the text, it actually doesn't say there is no Yoresh Etzer. Go back and look at the text. We're making assumptions. It says, Ve'ein machalim davar. There is no one who would shame them with speech or something along those lines. And then it says, Yoresh Etzer, which may be taken as hereditary ruler. It doesn't say there is none. It could mean that there actually is. The whole clause is so hard to understand. So I'm going to come back to the machlim, that there is no one to shame them with speech. I want to come back to that phrase. Let's tackle Yoresh Etzer, first of all. So there are two different tracks among the commentators, at least that I've seen, and their split is based on whether you believe that Ein applies to this phrase or not. Is it saying there is no Yoresh Etzer or there is Yoresh Etzer? Radak brings two approaches. His second approach, as well as that of Abarbanel, and that brought by Professor Elitzur in the Dot Mikra edition, is what everybody here saw in their translations, which is that Ein is part of this. There is no ruler, there is no inherited ruler. Ralbag has it also. Ralbag has a very fancy idea. He says that when you have a ruler who inherits the land, he's willing to risk far more to protect it, because he's got a lot of at stake. It's his family's dynasty. Which is an interesting idea, kind of out of left field. But basically, this is one school of thought that says there is no ruler, there is no hereditary ruler. That's one view. The other view, Rashi's view, and the first view brought in Radak, is that there is Yoresh Etzer, and what Yoresh Etzer means is not a ruler who controls and who is hereditary, but rather Etzer means something else. We've been rendering, for the most part, Etzer as somebody who is in power, someone who stops people from doing things that they're not supposed to be doing, like Atzor, to halt, right? The stop sign says Atzor. However, Etzer could mean small. Something that is very small. So that Rashi suggests what it's saying is, Ein Yoresh Etzer means there are very few heirs who are going to come after Dun for conquering those who are living there. There are very few people who are holders of land who are going to be able to come after them if they take it. I think it's a little bit like the pasuk in Hazinu, Ve'efes Atzur Ve'azuv. Atzur there may be an example of this. So, two different approaches. Either it's saying there is no ruler, no hereditary ruler perhaps, or it's saying there are few people who own land hereditarily in their family. The upshot, whichever way you read it, is that what it's saying is they are vulnerable. Either because they don't have a good, big, powerful ruler, or because you don't have the landowners. And then it continues in that vein, as per Rashi saying, they're far from Tzidon. Tzidon would have been the ones to help them, living way up north. Tzidon should have come to their aid, but they're not going to get help because Tzidon is far away. And Davar in Lahemim Adam, Rashi says, they don't have any allies. They have no sworn allies. So these people are sitting ducks. That's the message. Note, I didn't explain yet the phrase Ein Machlim. I'm going to come back to that shortly. But what's being presented here universally, according to all of the commentaries that I can find on here, is these people are so out of luck. Dun is coming their way, and nothing is going to stop them. Clear?
They're done.
Exactly. Precisely. So, if you take a look at Pasuk Chet, sentence 8, Vayavo al achayhem tsar'a ve'eshto'ol. These five men, it took them one pasuk to do the reconnaissance. So these five men come back to their brothers in Dan, Tzara'ah, and Eshta'ol. Remember those cities again from Shimshon's story. Exactly. Vayomru lahem acheihem ma'atem. And their brethren say to them, who are you? Not literally, who are you? But what do you have to report? If you think of Rus, right? When she comes back from visiting Boaz, Naomi says to her, mi'at bt. Who are you? My daughter, what news do you have? What's going on? What happened? Give us a status report. So vayomru, they said back, kuma v'na'ale aleihem. Let's go. Get up and go. Ki ra'inu es ha'aretz. We've seen the land. V'hine tova me'od. It's really good. V'atem machshim. And you guys are just delaying back here. What are you asking us questions for? Al te'atzlu. Don't be lazy. L'aleches levo l'areshes es ha'aretz. To go take this land. This is it. It is ours. And not just that. One more pasuk. Kivalachem. When you arrive, tavo el amvoteach. You're going to come to these people who are so vulnerable. They're just sitting there thinking they're safe. V'ha'aretz rachavas yadayim. This land is big and broad. Kinesana elokim v'yadchem. God, if this is a reference to God, has put it into your hands. Mekom asher ein sham machsor. Kol davar asher ba'aretz. There is nothing lacking there. Whatever you want, it's all there. The land is great. The land's available. Let's get up and go. That's your section. Boy, are they excited. They found out they're playing the Jets this week. This is, to them, this is great. We got it all. So, I want to come back, though, to one particular piece of this, which is the people of Laish are compared to Tzidonim. I think that's really interesting here. What is our relationship with Sidon? You know anything about Sidon?
Sea people north of Israel, on the coast, presumably from the, Aegean, perhaps.
Yeah, they're sea people. They live up there, that's right. They're often associated with Tzor, with Tyre. They go together, Tzor vit Sidon. I think they're in Lebanon today, no? I think that's where they would be today. So we have an old relationship with Sidon. Not in the days of Shoftim. In the days of Shoftim, it's not old.
Sorry? In the days of Shlomo?
Good. In the days of Shlomo. Excellent. David points it out. Take a look at your sheet at source number 2. Shlomo wants to build a Beis HaMikdash, and he needs to get wood. So this is from Malachim Aleph Perek Hey. If you're using a Tanakh, you can look it up in your Tanakh and you'll see the English as well. I did not bring this to the English on the sheet. Vayishlach Shlomo el Hiram Lemor. Shlomo sends to Hiram, king of Tzur. Of Tzor, I should say. Ataya data es David Avi. You know my father David. Kilo yachol ibnos bayis l'shem Hashem elokav. He was not able to build a house for God. Mipnei ha-milchama asher sivavuhu, because of the war that surrounded him. Ateis Hashem osam tachas kapos raglai, until God placed all those nations beneath my feet. Right? The whole discussion about why David can't build the Beis HaMikdash. Is it because he was successful in war? Is it because he shed blood? Is it all different explanations that are offered? Here, he just says, yeah, he couldn't build it because he was busy fighting. Ve'atah, now, Heiniach Hashem Elokai li misaviv, God has given me space. Ein Satan vein pegara, no one to undermine me. No problems for me to deal with. V'hinini omer, so I wanted to build. Livnos bayis l'shem Hashem Elokai, kasher diber Hashem el David lemor, bincha asher atein tachtecha kisacha, al kisecha, hu yivna bayis l'shmi. I want to do what God said I would do. God said to David, your son is going to build it? That's me. Ve'ata, so he says to Chiram, tzavei, give the order. V'yichrusuli arazim min Lebanon. Let them cut cedars for me from Lebanon. V'avadai yehiu im avadecha. My guys will work with your guys. Uschar avadecha etein l'cha. And I will pay for your workers. K'chol asher tomar. Whatever you say. Ki atay adata ki ein banu ish yodea l'chros etzim katzidonim. because we don't have anybody who knows how to cut wood like the Tzidonim. It's like the old joke, right? How many Jewish lumberjacks do you know? He says, we don't make lumberjacks. We need to hire them. So that's his statement. So here, the Tzidonim seem to be good guys, right? We like them. They're going to cut the wood for the Beis Hamikdash. A little further along in history, though, it's not so good. There's a woman who is the daughter of the king of Tzidon, who ends up marrying a Jewish king. Anyone know who that is? Daughter of the king of the Tzidonim, who marries a Jewish king. Her name is Izebel. Jezebel is a Tzidonite. We don't like her. She marries Ahav. Whole discussion about her conversion, not for us for right now, but this is not good. And later on, in some situation that really is not well defined and the commentators debate, they become our enemies. The Navi Yoel, who is found in Treyasar, has a prediction of punishment coming to the nations for what they've done to us. And he targets the Tzidonim, Tzor and Sidon. Take a look at source number 3. Really, all the sea peoples. He says, "V'gam ma'atem li Tzor v'Tzidon v'chogli lots plushes." What are you to me, Tzor, Tyre, Sidon, as well as all of those who came from Pleshet, all of those sea peoples we talked about? And he says, "Swiftly, I am going to pay you back for what you did." What is it that they did? Pasuk Hey in source number 3. Asher kaspi uzahavi lekachtem. You took my silver and gold. Umach madaya tovim havesem lehecholechem. And you took all of my treasures to your palaces. Ubnei Yehuda ubnei Yerushalayim mechartem libnei hayivanim. You sold off the people of Judea and the people of Jerusalem to the sons of the Yevanim. Leman hachikam me'al gevulam, to distance them from their lands. Hineni mi'iram min amakom asher mechartem osem shama. Well, I have bad news. I'm bringing the Jews back from those lands where you sold them, and I'm going to pay you back, and I'm going to sell your kids, and so on. That's Yoel, the fourth perek. You can also find more punishment predicted for Tzidon in Yeshaya chapter 23 and Yechezkel chapter 28. There's some level of betrayal, it seems, that Sidon was our ally until they weren't our ally. So that's just background on the Tzidonim. But the question still is, why did you mention them? Why throw in that the people of Laish are like Tzidonim? This isn't what Dun says. This is before that. This is the Navi telling you something, trying to instruct you of something. It doesn't seem to be about a historical relationship that hasn't yet happened. I think it's about something else. Do you see anything in the description of Tzidon here that you look at and say, hey, wait a minute, there's something we're supposed to learn from this?
Maybe that they shouldn't trust their tranquility, that tranquility doesn't last forever?
Maybe. How would
I think there's an inference, because if you read the entire pasuk, Rechokim Hema Mitzidonim, the Davar Elahem Imadam, suggesting that the Tzidonim acted differently, that they had dealings with other people. And that perhaps the dealings of the Tzidonim were inappropriate.
That's an interesting idea. In other words, what you're saying is the people of Laish Leshem don't have anything to do with anybody, but the Tzidonim do.
Yes.
Possible. I'd go a little bit of a different route, although I hear what you're saying there. In general, in terms of the way we are describing the people in Laish, who we say are like the Tzidonim, you find two tracks in the commentators. One track is to say they are peaceful, they are secure, they are not afraid of war. So, for example, take a look at source number 4 at Radak. He says, Hatzidonim hayu krovim la'eretz Yisrael. Tzidon is right near Israel. It's not in Israel. This is part of that view that La'ish Leshem is out of Israel. They're further north. Vayu shoktim, they were at peace. Kiloayu rotzim lehilachem imahem. Kiloayu meretz Canaan. They didn't want to go to war with them. They're not from Canaan, meaning they don't think we're an enemy. We are there to take Eretz Canaan. We're not there to take their land. So they're very peaceful and they're cool. They don't care about what we're doing. Ein Machalim also is taken to reflect a level of peace and of security. Rashi says they don't need to ask for anything and get turned down. I brought you on the sheet in source number 5 what David says regarding the shepherds of a man named Naval, that they always asked for stuff and we never turned them down. Lo hechlam num. We never put them to shame. Radak says they had no one to fear among their neighbors. There is no klima, there's no shame, there's no fear, they're peaceful and secure. That's one take when we describe Laish as well as the Tzidonim. The other take, which is not mutually exclusive, is that they are an advanced, sophisticated nation. And within this read, machlim is something else. Machlim is not, they're never put to shame. It's, they don't have a king to put them to shame, because they don't need a king. Ein machlim, there is no one to tell people what to do, because they don't need someone to tell them what to do. Take a look at Ralbag in number 6. He says, "V'lo haya ba'aretz ahi machlim davar sheyoresh hamalucha." He says there was no one there who would shame others. I believe he means verbally. Machlim davar is the way he's taking the pasuk. No one to shame others verbally. No one who inherited the monarchy, taking yoresh etzer as inheriting the monarchy. V'ua moshel, meaning the ruler. Shumachlim besochachto hachotim, who shames those who sin with his rebuke. So Ralbag says, you didn't have anybody who was telling people what to do. Abarbanel goes even further. Abarbanel is the king of anachronism. He's a lot of fun. Abarbanel will take things from his time. Remember, he is the end of the 15th century, right? He is among those Jews who leave Spain in the expulsion. So Abarbanel loves to apply things from his day to events in Tanakh. And he doesn't care that thousands of years have elapsed in between. I'll give you an example. If we get to it in Shmuel one day, you'll remember it then. When Shmuel retires, Shaul is appointed king. So Shmuel gives a big speech. And he says, judge me, tell me, have I done anything wrong before God and before his appointed one? And all the commentators want to know, why is Shmuel calling to be judged? So Abarbanel says it's because there's a practice that when a new ruler steps into office, his first job is to judge the acts of the previous ruler and then to punish him if anything was inappropriate. And Shmuel is saying, judge me, you know, Shaul, the anointed one, should now judge everything that I did. Which, you know, is very interesting, but it was something that they're doing in Spain in the 15th century. That doesn't mean that the Jews were doing it, you know, millennia earlier. But look what he does here. This is how Abarbanel reads the Tzidonim. He says, Va'achshov, you know what I think? Sh'atzidonim hayu anashim socharim. They were merchants. Misnahagim tamid banhagos tovos b'li melech. They acted positively without a king. Kemosha'od hayom osin ha-Venetians, va-Florentines, veha, I don't know who the other one is who he's writing about, Zenobish, I don't know who he's referring to there. Ush'ar ha-amim asher be'eretz Italia, and other nations in Italy, omdim ba-hagosehem, b'li amlachas melech besocham, they don't need to have a king. All these provinces manage just fine with their democratic parliaments, and they don't need to have a king. And he goes on at length, I brought you just like one sentence. So he says, that's what the Tzidonim are like. They don't need a king. They don't have somebody telling them what to do. They're an advanced, sophisticated nation of nice people. So what you're seeing here is a description of Tzidonim, really separate from what would end up being their bad relationship with us, highlighting either they're peaceful and secure, no one to put anyone to shame, they're not afraid of war, or alternatively, they're an advanced, sophisticated nation, they don't need a king, they just do what's right. Isn't it wonderful? Wouldn't you want to live there? Like, this is like an ad for, you know, go become a Tzidoni. But now tell me something. What's the message? What's the message for the Jewish reader of Tanakh? Within any read of the Tzidonim, any of the things we said.
That you need a king.
Really?
Well, we started off the Perek saying this is the time that Bnei Israel did not have a king, and we're saying this is the lead up to the next stage where we get a king.
Yeah.
And these poor Tzidonim who are living a utopian life, so to speak, are going to lose it because you don't have someone to unite them.
Interesting. So Howie goes the exact opposite way that from what I would have done, which is cool. Howie says the message is you need a king, because look what happens when you don't have a king. Dunn comes to town and rolls right over you. But I would argue, yeah, this is rebuke. Here we are, Ein Melech b'Yisrael. We have no king, and Ein Yoresh Etzer. We have no hereditary ruler. One of the hallmarks of the Shoftim is that they don't pass the rule from generation to generation. We had some who tried. It didn't work out. And yet, they're well-mannered, nice, secure people who manage their affairs. Nobody is being shamed. Everything is wonderful. And south of the border are the Jews. And they can't get their act together. They're fighting with each other, they're not helping each other, they're not settling the land they're supposed to settle, they're veering off into idolatry. I think it's straight rebuke. And I'll prove to you, well, I can't prove it, but I'll show you evidence to support the idea that it's rebuke. Did you notice anything interesting in the language that they used when they described this land that they want to conquer? Any turns of phrase that catch your eye?
Ba'aretz?
I'm sorry?
Ba'aretz?
What about
it? There's no, like, calling it the land?
Well, that's true, but you could read that referring to Israel. In other words, called it Ba'aretz, everything that we have exists there.
Sher Ein Shem Machzor.
Yeah.
Where there's nothing lacking.
Right. So why does that catch your eye?
Because it seems to imply that it really provided for everything, that there was real tranquility there.
That's true. I want to pick out something else. It's true, but I want to pick out something else.
I was to guess, Rabbi?
Yes.
I'd like to compare the language that the spies brought back.
Bingo.
Eretz Yisrael.
Bingo. When you look at this language in Pasuk Tet, let's go. We've seen the land. V'hine tova me'od. Not only is it good, it is tov me'od. And take a look in source number 8 on your sheet at the words that I bolded. When the Meraglim come back, Kalev says, V'yomru ha'kol adas b'nei Yisrael le'mor ha'aretz asher avarnu va lasur osa tova ha'aretz me'od me'od. This land is really, really good. So Kalev, trying to persuade the Jews, uses this language, and more, in Pasuk Yud, Kivalachem tavo'u el am boteach, you will come to a nation that is secure, v'ha'aretz rachavas yadayim. The land is wide open. So look at what I brought you in source number 8. That's Shechem talking. Chamor talking, really. But Chamor and Shechem, regarding the covenant they want to make with the Jews. We just do bris milah, and then they'll marry among us and all of that. So they say, v'ha'aretz hinei rachavas yadayim lifnehem. Same turn of phrase. What I am suggesting here is that you're seeing language borrowed from the story of the spies. Granted, it's Kalev speaking, but it's the story of the spies. And you're seeing language borrowed from Hamor trying to persuade Shechem. And maybe what it's saying, maybe the way you could look at it is this, actually. The drive for settling Israel can be inspired. It can be like Kalev. It can be Tova Haaretz Me'od Me'od. Or it can be corrupt. Chamor. V'haaretz Hinei Rachavas Yadayim. And the people of Dan are acting out of greed. That wasn't supposed to be the motivation for settling Canaan. That wasn't what it was about. It was never about, hey, let's take as much land as we can take. It was about creating a land in which Hashem would be served. It was about creating a model of life which would attract the Canaanim to want to be Geirei Toshav, to accept the 7 universal laws. And this is an example of how far we've sunk. You want to see a good model? Look at the Tzidonim. They've got their act together. You want to see a bad model? Look at the Jews. Neither one has a king. But on one side, they're doing just fine. And on the other side, it's the Book of Shoftim. You follow? Yes, Chuck.
In the Maggid series on Ruth, she has a theory that we needed a king. To be without a king was bad. If it's possible, I think, there's a Rashi on Derech Eretz Plishtim. Why did they want us to go through there? Because Plishtim had a highly evolved, sophisticated society where there were rules which was not based on divine order, but logic. Maybe the problem with this place was they didn't have a melech. They didn't have a divine constitution like the Torah. And this was a flawed part. This was a flawed thing that they didn't want us to emulate. We have our own problems down south. We're barbarians. But this evolved society is a bigger risk to us because it suggests that they can be honorable people without belief in God.
Mm-hmm. So you would see this as a threat?
Yes. I would see it as a threat. I think the author of the Maggid series on Ruth would see it as a threat. It fits into her theory.
Okay. I mean, that's certainly an idea that we find in plenty of Jewish thought. I mean, the Kuzari is built on that idea. That when you're trying to figure out what God wants based on your own logic, you're always going to go wrong. So we do find that. Yes, Howie.
Chuck is sort of taking my direction, which is scary. But the other thing is, you know, with Rashi and with other explanations, they're saying Dan is only trying to inherit what is theirs. And yet the expressions that you're using or the way you're explaining what Dan is saying, what they're going to do, inherit what is meant for them, you've taken it as a negative.
Well, I'm taking the point that not everybody believes that this was land that was actually meant for them. That we saw a substantive view that said that they're actually, you know, going to land that they have no right to, and they aren't meant to go to at all.
So how does someone like Rashi deal with these phrases, or is it just ignored?
What do you mean?
Well, does he take it as a negative and look at, or...
Rashi doesn't comment on the Meraglim Association or the Chamor Association. Rashi does comment, I believe, on the greed in general. I'm just looking back in my notes, but I actually didn't print out the ones from our discussion about whether they're supposed to have this land or not, so I don't have that in front of me to see which side Rashi had taken there. No one among the Mefarshim is going to be happy with Dan by the end of this story. The only question is, what mistake did they make and how badly did they do it? But it's very clear. I mean, Dunn is acting out of greed. Even if they are settling the land God sent them, they're doing it for all the wrong reasons. And that in and of itself is problematic, even if this is land that was meant for them. Okay. So let's see some of this. Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11. Let's watch what happens. Vayis'u mishami mishpachas hadani mitzara ume eshta'ol. Right? We're really drumming in the tzara eshta'ol point, and I think it has to be because of the Shimshon piece of it, that everybody is always going to identify that with Shimshon. So they travel from tzara and eshta'ol, shesh meos ish, chagur klei melchama, 600 men. This is actually a really interesting line. Right? First of all, 600 men is not a lot. That you're going to conquer this huge space that's going to be suitable for this large tribe of Dun. Right? You're really confident. I remember, Gideon panicked because he only had 300 men. Right? Now you're going to do this with 600. But that's an interesting pasuk for another reason we're going to come back to. Vayalu vayachanu b'kiryas yarim b'Yehuda. They ascended, they camped in Kiryat Yarim, which is in Yehuda. Al-Kain Karula Makoma Humachne Dun Adayom Azeh, giving the place the name, the camp of Dun. Hinei Achare Kiryat Yarim, it's right next to Kiryat Yarim. Vayavru Misham Har Ephraim, they're working their way north. And so they go from there to Har Ephraim. Vayavu at base Micha. And lo and behold, they're gonna go through Micha's area. Vayanu Chameshes Anashim Ha'ochim L'Ragela Sa'aretz Layish. So those five men who had been in the original reconnaissance trip, who had gone to Laish, they declared, "Vayomru alachem." They said to their brethren, "Haydatem ki yesh babatim ha'ela efod usrafim ufesel umasecha." You know what they have here? They have an efod, that priestly jacket. They have trafim, which are either some kind of idol or they are used to tell the future. They have statues, molten images. Ve'ata, and now, du mata'asu. You know what to do. It's a very fun turn of phrase there. You know what to do. Well, they do it. Vayasuru shama. So they veered off of the road in order to go to Micha's house. Vayavo el beis hanar halevi beis Micha. They come to the house of this youth, the Levi, the house of Micha. Vayishalu lo l'shalom. And they said, how you doing? V'sheish meyos ish chagurim klei milchamtam nitzavim pesach hashar. By the way, 600 men girded with weapons are standing by the door. Asher b'bnei Dan, these 600 men from Dan. V'ya'alu chameshes ha'anoshim ha'olchim l'rageles ha'aretz ba'u shaman. Those five original spies, they came to the house. Lakchu es ha'pesel ves ha'efod ves ha'trafim ves ha'masecha. And they say, excuse me, we're taking this. And they take the statue, and they take the ephod, and they take the trafim, and whatever molten image was there also. Va'kohen nitzav pesach hashar, and this Levi slash Kohen is standing by the gate. V'sheish me'os ha'ish ha'chagur klei ha'milchama, and the 600 men, who, by the way, are wielding weapons. And these guys, they all went into the house and they took everything. And the Kohen says to them, excuse me, but we have a no-touch rule here, right? You're allowed to look, but you're not allowed to touch. What are you doing? And they said to him, Hachareish. They said, be quiet. Sim yadcha al picha, put your hand on your mouth. V'lech imanu, and go with us. V'heyeh lanu la'avu l'kohen. Now you can be an av and a kohen for us. Bonus. Not only that. Hatov heyoscha kohen lebeis ish echad. Oh, yosha kohen l'shevet l'shpacha b'Yisrael. What would you rather? Right? Would you rather be an av and a kohen in Micha's house, so whoever's traveling on the road gets to stop in and you can conduct a little service? We're a whole tribe. It's an upgrade. You should come to us. You started out as this Levi. You became a Kohen. They gave you a little stipend there, made you happy. Come on. Come with us. That's what you should do. Vayitav Leva Kohen. The Kohen loves it. Vayikachas ha'efod v'ashatrafim v'ashapasel, and he takes the ephod, and he takes the trafim, and he takes the statue. Vayavo bekerav ha'am, and he joins the people of Dan. Pause there. The story's in the middle, but pause there for a minute. This is an awesome story. This is great. First of all, did you notice a phrase that was repeated three times here, describing the people of Dan? There was a phrase that was said three times about the people of Dan here. The first time it showed up was in sentence 11. The second time it showed up was in sentence 16, unless that was the third. That might be the third. But it's in 16 also. And there was one other use of it. No. It shows up three times. I'm only seeing two right now, but there is a third.
In section, in episode 18, Chagur.
Ah, that's why. Right, you've that's not in 18. It's in 17. It's in 17, the end of 17.
Sorry.
End of 17. 11, 16, and 17. They have clay milchama. They've got weapons. Jews in Shoftim never have weapons. It's a theme, right? We have Ehud, who's got his unique, specially designed lefty dagger that he made for himself at home. You've got cattle goad for Shamgar ben Anat. You've got Yael with her tent peg. You've got Shimshon with the jawbone of a donkey. The Jews are never depicted in this book as having real weapons. The people of Canaan have chariots to fight Devorah and Barak. The Jews don't, and that's why the Jews are driven up into the mountains. This is part of the transformation. The Jews have become like the Canaanim. Look, we even have weapons. And we're going to mention it three times in the course of the story in order to highlight the fact that we are dangerous people. We've got weapons now. That was one thing I thought that was interesting here.
Okay, so again, this is where I get confused, because if you want to say that this story occurs after Yeshua...
Good.
...then it doesn't work. Like, I run into difficulty when we have explanations that you can't apply them consistently through the story.
Right. I think this is evidence to support the idea that in fact this happened at the end. I don't think it's ironclad. I think you can make this work with being in the beginning, but I think it's smoother to read this as the end. Yeah. Let's go back through the psukim for a minute, because I think there's something else that people miss. Go back to sentence 17. So, in sentence 17, those five men arrive. They want to take the idol, the statue, whatever it is. The Levi is standing at the entrance to the house. Okay, so he's out at the gate. He's talking to the 600 people at the gate. In the meantime, in sentence 18, the five guys come into the house of Micha. They take the statue, the trafim, whatever it is. They walk out of the house. The Levi sees them, and he says, "What are you doing?" And they tell him, "Be quiet, and come with us." And he says, "Okay." And he takes the ephod, the trafim, and so on. Did you notice who takes the stuff? He now takes it himself. He's totally bought in. He's going to help them steal all. He's not even pretending to be a hostage. He's carrying the stuff out on his own. He's totally bought into this. So what happens now? Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayifnu vayelechu. They leave. Vayasimo as hatap ve'as hamikneh ve'as hakvuda lifnehem. They put the children and the cattle and the kavuda in front of them. Kavuda is an interesting word. Here, Professor Elitzur says it means the property. It's a word with certain other uses as well. Interestingly, it's actually the term used on El Al today for a carry-on. This term, the kavuda. Rashi says here it means heavy items. Radak says it means movable property. But did you notice what else they had in this sentence?
Their children.
Their children. Why in the world are you bringing your children?
To settle there.
Yeah, but you're going to war.
We're confident that they could win quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of confidence here. If you take a look at Radak in source number 9 on the sheet, he says, Elu Shesh Meos Ish Chagur Klei Milchama, these 600 men with their weapons, Im Tapam Unishayham Umiknehem Holchu. They went with their wives, they went with their kids, they went with their cattle, Ki Ayu B'tuchim Sheyul Kedu Ha'ir. They said, we're sure we can take this. They're so sure that they bring their children. It's not like the whole tribe is going. This is just 600 men. But the 600 men said, yeah, let's bring the kids along. It'll be good. They'll tour a little bit. We'll stop off. We'll see something, take some pictures. It'll all be over quickly, and then we'll be able to settle, and we'll be there before anybody else. That's what they do. So, the story is not over though. Micha's not done. Hema herchiku mi beis Micha. So they're far now from the house of Micha. The people who live in the neighboring houses are roused. And they go running after the people of Dan. Hey, what are you doing? You took the idols. That's no good. They call to the people of Dan. We're in 23. And the people of Dan turn their faces. That's a beautiful expression. In other words, they didn't stop. They're still going. They just turn their faces. Vayomru leMicha, and they said to Micha, Malacha kiniz akta. What's the big deal? What's going on? Vayomer, and he says, without a trace of irony, Es Elohai asher asisi lekachtem. You took the God I made. What a farce of a sentence. You took the God I made. Is it a God? How did they take it? A God you made? What does that even mean? Ve'as ha-kohen, and you took my Levi. Va'telchu, and you left. Umaliod, what am I going to have left? Umaza tamur alai malach, why are you saying to me, what's your deal? You know what my deal is. Va'yomu elav b'nei Dan. And the people of Dan turn around and they say, Al tashma kolcha imanu. Don't make your voice heard to us. Don't speak like that. There are some dangerous people here. There are some men of bitter spirit here. You don't want to mess with them. Gather in your life and that of your household. The Radak says in source number 10, Atatia gorem shetamusu kulchem im tashmiem kolecha v'tosif ledaber ol badavar hazeh. He says, you're going to cost yourself your life and that of your family. You better just, you know, be happy that you're still alive, is what they say to him. And they go on walking. Micha sees he's outnumbered. And he goes home. Now you understand why I find this story to be funny. This is the opposite of Pilegesh Begiva. There is no humor in Pilegesh Begiva, but this story is just awesome. Everybody here is funny. You've got the Levi, the upwardly mobile Levi. You've got Micha, who thought it was a good idea to set up this idol in the first place, and now he's angry, you stole my God. And you have these people of Dan, who are just a bunch of ruffians, who think, oh, look, there's a statue there, let's go take it. Okay. They're a bunch of thugs. They turn around when he comes out after them, and they say, listen, you better just keep quiet, because you never know what's going to happen if you annoy somebody. It's really remarkable. So I think what we'll do next time with this is to see what happens with Dan and what happens with the city, because what Dan does to the city is a little strange. We'll have to talk about that, as well as the fate of Micha's statues. And then we're going to have to come back to who this Levi is and what we're supposed to learn from the identity of the Levi, because there's an awful lot to deal with from that perspective as well. But what we picked up here is really more of the decay that you see in Shoftim, and especially that fascinating contrast with the people of Sidon and the people of Laish, who also have no ruler, but they have not suffered, they have not deteriorated in the way that in the way that the Jews have. Okay? Good. So we'll pick up, God willing, next Tuesday.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.